There are 8 million stories in the Naked City. This has been one of them.
So, who's your friend?
Peter Bosch, the future of rock and roll.
You're so money and you don't even know it. That's what I keep saying.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building.
Turn it off, it gets in the way.
Hey, what's all this mix-up? Our true enemy has yet to reveal himself.
We had some good sleep last night. At least
ways I did. Do you know what that was?
Welcome.
Let me bring you up to speed.
Soon, very soon, there won't be any books or newspapers, no telephones.
Welcome.
We'll only be able to communicate with email and QVC. We'll all be interactive.
You've got mail.
All you need to see and hear, you'll see and hear without ever having to rise from your Sealy Posturepedic. I'm talking about high definition. I'm talking about virtual reality. I'm talking about living in the fast lane, the electronic information superhighway.
Yeah, it's the link.
Welcome.
The electronic information superhighway.
Welcome.
Yeah, it's the link.
I'm talking about mixedup.com.
It's the link.
Welcome.
I've got the strangest feeling someone's gonna kick his ass.
Welcome.
Mixedup.com.
It's the link.
I'm talking about mixedup.com.
Welcome.
Come. There they go. Two criminal geniuses locked away together.
Mixedup.com.
Who knows what diabolical schemes they might concoct.
Mixedup.com.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
And welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. This week is our annual LGBT Health Special. It's part of the way we commemorate LGBT Pride Month every year. In the first half of the program, we'll be taking a look at all the congressional doings around healthcare legislation and what it specifically means for the LGBT community. And in the second half of the show, we'll be hearing excerpts from the recent ACT UP 30th Anniversary Hidden Voices Conference and how that related to the LGBT community. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The Los Angeles Times reports that we Americans should all expect a drama-filled days of mock hand-wringing, political jockeying, and backroom brinksmanship as the Senate Republican health care bill heads toward a hoped-for vote later this week. No sooner did Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell unveil the long-awaited bill last week than Republican senators started openly negotiating what it would take to actually win their votes. Within just a few hours, four key conservative senators jointly announced they could not possibly vote for the bill as it is unless it more fully guts the Affordable Care Act. Likewise, centrists withheld their support unless they can push the bill more the other way, as they mull the fallout from leaving millions more Americans uninsured. Even President Trump, who called the House overhaul bill mean, initially withheld his endorsement, suggesting a little negotiation would make the Senate version, quote, very good. Later on, he tweeted that he was supportive, but he looked forward to making it, quote, very special. Almost certainly, McConnell opened the door to the haranguing by presenting the legislation as a discussion draft and inviting input to make it better. After being widely panned by Democrats and Republicans alike for crafting the bill with unprecedented secrecy, keeping details even from Republican senators, McConnell may now be eager to convey a sense of open debate and negotiation. However, if the process that played out in the House last month is any guide, expect the deal-making to only go so far before Republicans quickly unify, preferring to hold hands and jump off a political cliff together rather than risk losing their best opportunity to fulfill their promise to repeal the current law. With Republicans holding a slim 52-seat majority, Senate leaders can only afford to lose support from two Republican senators and still pass the bill in the face of unanimous Democratic opposition. In many ways, the negotiations will give senators something they've not had during the crafting of the bill behind closed doors in recent weeks, a chance to publicly muscle and maneuver their concerns to the forefront of the debate. Even if senators are not successful in changing the bill, they will be able to show their constituents that at least they tried. The risks are clear. If Republicans fail to repeal the law after years of promising to do so, they face the wrath of conservative voters and outside interest groups. However, if their overhaul leaves millions of Americans without coverage or raises costs significantly, the backlash could be intense. Polls show that the Affordable Care Act's popularity has soared since recent repeal efforts began, and Americans largely oppose the health bill, House health bill. California Healthline reports that the so-called single-payer health care, a longtime goal of progressive Democrats and the California Nurses Association, is dead for now in the state's legislature, and no further action will be taken in 2017. A bill pushing a state-based single-payer system was brought to a halt last week when Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon declined to move it forward. The bill will not get a hearing by the Assembly Rules Committee before the July 14th deadline, though it could be taken up again in 2018. It passed the California Senate earlier this month. The term single-payer generally refers to health care systems in which the government pays doctors and other health providers using tax revenues, bypassing the use of private insurance companies as middlemen. In some systems, the doctors work directly for the government, but the California bill proposes a variant in which doctors and hospitals remain private entities and establish contracts with the state to provide care. Speaker Rendon described himself as a longtime supporter of a single-payer system, but said the current bill was woefully incomplete and didn't address the realities of both the Trump administration and voters' concerns. In legislative slang, the Healthy California Act was a, quote, shell bill. It described a long list of covered services and claimed residents would not have to pay any premiums or co-pays. Based on the raw outline, two studies tried to estimate the total cost. One came up with $400 billion a year, and another said $330 billion. Speaker Rendon said this action does not mean the bill is dead. In a statement, he encouraged single-payer supporters in the Senate to use the time to fill in the holes in the bill and provide more information about financing, delivery of care, and cost controls. The two authors of the bill were disappointed by the move, but vowed to keep fighting for it in the future. And finally, the website Stat reports that leaders of Congressional HIV/AIDS Caucus are demanding answers from the White House after a mass exodus from a presidential advisory group. Representatives Barbara Lee of California and Eliana Ross Lightnin of Florida, the co-chairs of the group, delivered a letter last week to President Trump that called for the White House to back off proposed budget cuts to HIV/AIDS programs, revamp the current blank website it scrubbed in January, and appoint a national AIDS policy director. All this happened after six council members jointly resigned. Those members slammed Trump for not caring about the issue in a public letter of resignation they released earlier this month. A seventh member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS, Dr. Jeffrey Ackman, the dean of George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, also resigned recently, according to a spokesman from the Department of Health and Human Services. In their resignation letter, published as an op-ed in Newsweek, the advisory council members wrote that the Trump administration has no strategy to address the ongoing HIV/AIDS epidemic, seeks zero input from experts to formulate HIV policy, and most concerning, pushes legislation that will harm people living with HIV and halt or reverse important gains made in the fight against this disease. The council's charter calls for a maximum of 25 members, but there's no membership minimum. As long as over half of the current members are present at meetings, the council can conduct business as usual. Following the resignations, the White House pointed out that members who resigned were Obama administration appointees, that Obama himself replaced much of Bush-appointed commission upon taking office, and that former members never reached out to the White House Domestic Policy Council with their concerns before resigning. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment in our annual LGBT Health Special, taking a look at the health care bills in Congress and what they might mean for LGBT people. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first segment of our annual LGBT Health Special this year, we're going to be taking a look at the current health care bills in Congress and what the implications may be for LGBT communities. Joining us is Kellen Baker, founding steering committee of Out to Enroll, and Jade Goodridge, who's a patient navigation coordinator for the LGBT Community Center here in New York City. Welcome back to Health Action, Kellen, and welcome to Health Action, Jade.
Hello.
Thanks so much.
So, Kellen, this is the first program that we're presenting since the Senate bill came out last week, in the broadest of strokes, because we don't have time on this program, and we do want to get to the actual substance of the matter. What's the Senate bill proposing, and what are sort of the basic differences, if any, between it and the House bill that we've seen earlier?
The Senate bill, just like the House bill, is enough to make you sick just looking at it. Although you better hope that you don't get sick, because both of these bills force people to pay more for worse coverage. There's not really a lot of substantive differences between the two. There's a little bit of difference in terms of how they structure some of their provisions. But the biggest change is actually what happens with the Medicaid program, which is the jointly run federal and state program for low-income people, people with disabilities, other folks who are unable to get insurance through the income or employer-based system of private insurance. The House bill has some pretty dramatic cuts to Medicaid, but the Senate bill is astoundingly even worse. So what we're looking at is unfortunately not just a return to pre-Affordable Care Act days, where a lot of folks had trouble getting coverage because of issues with pre-existing conditions, because of affordability. It actually takes us further back. It actually undermines the Medicaid program that has been a linchpin of the health insurance system and the healthcare system for low-income folks and others who need assistance getting coverage for 50 years. So this is a very bad bill indeed, and is, again, if anything, worse than the House passed bill.
Jade, you help people understand their enrollment options and get enrolled. Are people calling you up saying, what's going on? I'm worried.
They have and they have not. I think that when we initially got the shock that we were going to have this new person in charge of our administration here in the U.S., people were worried, more concerned then than they are now. I think people are still kind of waiting to hear what exactly is happening. They don't really understand the changes just yet. But that comes from a larger issue of us not knowing not understanding healthcare, health insurance largely as a culture. I think folks are mostly concerned about what will happen when they try to enroll later on. I think fairly recently we've seen a little bit of uptick with people that have currently been enrolled and them worrying about what will happen if they lose coverage during the year or if they've managed to, I guess, not enroll. So they're worried about the tax penalty. That's because they've heard about the whole mandate thing changing. So they're wondering if they can like get away with having to not be enrolled, or wondering if they will see a higher rate this year than they've paid in the last few years for not being covered. But the folks who actually are using the health insurance, they're holding on to it and just hoping that it will continue to be as it is. They don't really know what these changes mean for them just yet.
I think the good news is that should anything change, even if it's really dramatic, it's not going to change overnight. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Right.
Kellen, you mentioned the pre-ACA days. What did the ACA, how did LGBT folks actually benefit from the law? Let's sort of set a baseline here.
Sure. So the Affordable Care Act did two main things. One is it made a lot of changes or reforms to the delivery system for healthcare. So how you get healthcare, how it's organized, how it's paid for. That's something that's pretty weedy and actually not really affected by a lot of the changes in either the House passed bill or the Senate version. Both of those bills really go after the second big pillar of the Affordable Care Act, which is, of course, the expansion of health insurance coverage. Before the Affordable Care Act, there were an estimated 50 million people in the United States who did not have health insurance coverage, and that doesn't even count an estimated 11 million folks who are undocumented and do not have health insurance coverage. So the Affordable Care Act tried to change that in two ways. First is it expanded the Medicaid program, so making it possible for people with incomes under 133% of the poverty level, which is about $15,000 a year, to access Medicaid in every state. That was the intent of the Affordable Care Act, though, of course, that was subsequently changed by the Supreme Court. The Affordable Care Act also tries to expand private coverage. So that is the system of marketplaces that we were just talking about in terms of navigating and folks signing up for coverage. People were afforded health insurance credits or tax credits, I'm sorry, to make premiums more affordable, make it possible for more people to buy health insurance coverage through these marketplaces that were set up in every state. The most well-known name for the marketplace is, of course, healthcare.gov. So thanks to the Affordable Care Act, over 20 million people have new health insurance coverage. About half of that is through the Medicaid program in the 30-odd states that have expanded their programs under the Affordable Care Act. And about half of that is folks who have purchased plans through the marketplace with, again, the assistance of tax credits or subsidies to make the premiums more affordable.
And what did that mean for LGBT communities?
The Affordable Care Act has made a huge difference for LGBT communities in terms of the availability of coverage. One of the biggest changes that we saw in the Affordable Care Act is the elimination of pre-existing condition exclusions. So this idea that if you have basically ever needed health insurance in the past before, it was much more difficult to get health insurance in the future because insurance carriers would look at you and say, well, you've had treatment for cancer or you have asthma or any number of things that they could call a pre-existing condition and exclude you from coverage for that reason. And that is something that was very common targeting transgender people in particular. Gender dysphoria or a history of treatment related to gender transition was widely considered a pre-existing condition. Same for HIV. So under the Affordable Care Act, pre-existing condition exclusions are no longer allowed. And together with the affordability, the tax credits that make it more affordable and the expansion of Medicaid, we have seen uninsurance drop dramatically for LGBT folks over the last 7 years that the Affordable Care Act has been in place. And that's particularly true for folks sort of in the low and middle income range, up to about 400% of the federal poverty level. That's about $45,000 a year for an individual or about $90,000 a year for a family of three. The uninsurance rate in that group of LGBT people, low and middle incomes, dropped from 34%, so one in three uninsured before the Affordable Care Act came into effect. It's dropped to 22%. Just around one in five. So what we've seen is the Affordable Care Act has made a huge difference for LGBT communities. It has dramatically decreased the uninsurance rate, but we still see that there are a lot of LGBT folks who don't have insurance coverage. And that's just one of the many reasons why keeping the Affordable Care Act in place and strengthening it and expanding on it is an incredibly critical issue for LGBT communities.
So, Jatte, you're on the ground here in New York City. What has been you and your agency's work getting out into the community, letting people know about their options and getting enrolled?
Well, my navigation team is three people, and we're covering all of Manhattan and parts of Queens. When we initially set out to do this work, our focus was on the community of people that were both LGBTQ as well as Spanish-speaking, because there seemed to be a disparity there. And so we were reaching out to the neighborhoods that people tend to either not know that they can enroll, not know what health insurance enrollment looks like, and also to make sure that they know that we're there, that we also resemble who they are, too. So speaking their language, knowing what it means to be same-gender loving or same-sex and having a partner and wanting to enroll on the application, not worried about what that might look like to someone who doesn't understand that. But also in terms of people who are TGNC, transgender nonconforming, knowing what may come up with regards to their name and gender marker when they're applying on the application, how to answer the questions they need to be addressed in a safe, confident, and competent way. And so we're striving to do that by doing education outreach in the community, doing events, talking about what it means to have health insurance, what it means to use our health insurance, how it's going to cover our needs for ourselves and our family members. You know, it's, I think, also sharing stories about who's been covered and how the coverage works for them has been helpful, too, for our community, too. A lot of people don't know that prior to the Affordable Care Act going into play, that there wasn't coverage in New York for people who were living with HIV because they were considered having a pre-existing condition. So the ACA allowed them to have the Bridge program, which would cover them outside of their ADAP coverage, allowing them to see doctors and specialists for their other needs, not because they were diagnosed as being positive. The ACA also allowed people in the last 2 years who were over the Medicaid limit to get health care at a reasonable price. So outside of the rest of the U.S., the expansion was to 133%. To here it's 138% in New York. So that means somebody who is over, one person would be about $16,500 for one person. And New York expanded another program called the Essential Plan that's only offered in our state as well as, I believe, Minnesota, where folks who are over that Medicaid threshold that's already expanded up to about 250%. 200%. Are able to get health coverage at a well-subsidized rate of up to $20 per month for just the medical coverage, allowing them to still have access to their ambulatory care, their primary care, their needs for maternity care, needs for hospitalization, and not worry about falling in the gap without being covered. So New York's really trying to keep us covered and insured, and the EP, or the Essential Plan, also provides coverage for folks who are not necessarily how should I say this? They're folks who are over Medicaid limit, but people that are also Medicaid eligible based off their income, but not able to get Medicaid because federal dollars are being funded for that. So folks who are here currently on a 5-year ban because of their status as a transitioning immigrant can get coverage as well under the Essential Plan. And we want people to know that, because if you're here waiting to get your permanency and can't be covered because you're not considered a permanent resident, but you're here waiting, you need to be covered because you're going to be here for a while waiting on that. So.
Yeah, and that program, I think, covers people roughly up to about $25,000 a year income. So it's been a smashing success. There are about 700,000 New Yorkers that are on that program. So that's really good news. Kellen, the other thing the Affordable Care Act did was to bring in a bunch of civil rights protections. Can you tell us about that and how that relates to LGBT folks?
Yeah, the Affordable Care Act is really, in a lot of ways, a civil rights bill when it comes to the protections that are available for people trying to access health insurance coverage and health care. In particular, one provision of the Affordable Care Act, Section 1557, prohibits discrimination in health insurance and health care by any entity receiving federal dollars. So that's any hospital or health insurance carrier participating in Medicare or Medicaid or the health insurance marketplaces. Section 1557 prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, age, and disability. A lot of those protections were there before the Affordable Care Act, but one key one is new. That is the protection or the ban on discrimination on the basis of sex, which previously did not exist as a civil rights protection in the healthcare system. So the Affordable Care Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex. And according to a regulation from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, that sex non-discrimination provision specifically includes LGBT people. It includes gender identity, sex stereotyping, and the department also indicated that it would include sexual orientation in terms of investigating whether or not discrimination had occurred in any particular case. So it's a very broad regulation implementing this provision that protects LGBT people broadly from discrimination in health insurance coverage and healthcare. And Section 1557, something that's important to know about both the Senate bill and the House bill, is that that's just the top lines in terms of what we stand to lose. Because of the way these bills are being rammed through the Congress, they're not able to repeal any parts of the Affordable Care Act that don't directly affect the budget, so that don't directly implicate money. So Section 1557 doesn't. It's a civil rights provision that says, in effect, thou shalt not discriminate on these bases. So they cannot repeal this provision of the Affordable Care Act the way that they're ramming this legislation through now. That doesn't mean that that protection is safe, because what happens if we lose the Affordable Care Act, if we lose this fight in Congress now? What it does is it generates a potentially unstoppable wave of momentum that will allow the Trump administration to dismantle every other piece of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is largely implemented by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, which is under the control of a rabidly anti-LGBT, rabidly anti-Affordable Care Act secretary named Tom Price, who has pledged hand in hand with the president to do everything in his power to undermine the remaining protections and provisions of the Affordable Care Act. So we already know that Section 1557 is squarely in their targets. There has been some news that the department is already considering changes to the 1557 regulation, presumably to eliminate the protections for LGBT people as well as people who have had or need an abortion. And passage of the Affordable Care Act repeal bill in Congress would simply hand them even more momentum, even more tools to continue to tear down every other remaining part of the Affordable Care Act, including these non-discrimination protections.
Shadé, you and I were in a meeting in Albany last week where we had a whole bunch of health advocates from across the state. We're talking about, oh my God, what do we do? So how, aside from that conversation, maybe using that meeting as a stepping off point, how is the LGBT community beginning to mobilize in response to all this here in New York?
I'd say that we're really thinking about the ways that we are accessing our health care, not our health insurance, but like, where are we able to get things taken care of, our resources. We're at the center trying to work within our community to do more education about what's at stake with what changes are coming, and trying to understand better what it means to access health care now. What does it mean to deal with these bills that are in the works, right? And what will happen in the next few years? You know, things are not happening next week. They're going to happen in a few years from now. So if these things go through and they get passed and they're being suggested, the clock starts pretty much next year into 2020, depending on what things are going to be put into place. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about, you know, whether or not you are insured now, thinking about whether or not you, you know, have concerns about your family members and your immediate needs. I want to answer this better. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. You're doing fine.
So, I mean, I'll say that in my department specifically, which is government programs and affairs, we're trying our best to think about how we can advocate for our members of the community by understanding what it means when a bill is being suggested and how a law is passed and how it then breaks down into the community and how people are using it, and how it will affect us all. So what that means for us is reaching out to the same two demographics, people who are LGBTQ and Spanish speaking, to have them understand what's coming. It means...
Or could be coming.
Or could be coming.
Hopefully not coming.
Right. But I think also it's important to have them understand that this is going on now, that they're not just... having a blind eye or a deaf ear to it all. I think folks don't necessarily want to fan a fire unless it actually is happening, but we want them to know that it might be lit soon, you know? So we want to have them become more involved in what's going on and actually have a stake in what's going to, what could happen, Gilsene, that could happen, and maybe help it not happen, you know? Have them be more publicly aware and also be involved in things that are going on throughout the state, showing up to events where we do speak outs, you know, die-in, things like that, to kind of think about what's their personal connection to healthcare and health insurance access, and that they are part of this and they should be visible and they're upset and their anger and their need and their, you know, what this all means for them as citizens, as New Yorkers who are accessing health.
And Kellen, maybe the same question to you, but on a broader scale, how's nationally, how is the LGBT community responding to these bills?
I think there's this perception in a lot of places that healthcare is really complicated. And so people sort of feeling like maybe they don't know enough to get involved. They're not sure what to do next. Really, this bill is not very complicated. Even you can break it down to 140 characters for a tweet.
Go for it.
People and all of us pay more for worse coverage. That's all that's going on in this bill. It is a theme that is repeated over and over and over in terms of private coverage through the marketplaces and in terms of Medicaid coverage. We will all pay more for less. And a lot of us will die if this bill is passed. 40% of people living with HIV depend on Medicaid for their health care. This bill, the Senate bill, destroys Medicaid. Make no mistake about it. This is not tinkering around the edges. This is actually destroying the foundation of the Medicaid program, which has always been that if you need health care, the Medicaid program will be there for you within the income ranges that it has always operated in. What the Senate bill does is it caps the Medicaid program. It says we don't care how many people need coverage because we're going to give the states smaller and smaller and smaller amounts of money to cover fewer and fewer people. And with the rolling back of the subsidies that make private health insurance coverage more affordable, there will be no other option. So this is not a drill. I know, you know, we've heard this drumbeat over and over for the last 7 years since the Affordable Care Act was passed. There always seems to be some new threat to the Affordable Care Act. But now with Trump in the White House and both chambers of Congress in control or controlled by people who really do not seem to care about the lives of millions of people in this country, especially LGBT people, especially women, especially people living with HIV, the list could go on. Right. This is by far the most dangerous moment we have ever been in for the Affordable Care Act. So there has not been a very significant response to the need to call into Senate offices and tell our senators that we are not okay with this bill. We are not okay with watching millions of Americans die because the Senate and the House and the President are prepared to play politics with people's lives. So today, for example, is the National HIV Call-In Day to save healthcare, kill the bill, protect our care. So there are lists all over the internet of senators who are known to be wavering on whether or not this bill is too mean. And, you know, shocker, this bill is too mean. So they need to hear from their constituents. Even if you're in New York, call Schumer's office, call Gillibrand's office, tell them that you support their opposition to this bill, that you support everything they're doing to try to make sure that it does not pass. And if you have friends, family, anybody living in any other parts of the country, and again, there's a list of states with sort of key senators who are known to be wavering on this bill, reach out to them, have them call. This is not a drill. The Senate intends to pass this bill this week so that when senators go home for the 4th of July recess, they won't be able to be persuaded or dissuaded from doing this by any crowds in their hometowns. Okay. They wrote this bill in secret. They intend to pass it fast before we know what's hit us, and we cannot let that happen.
Great. Well, we've been getting an update here on the current healthcare bills and in particular what they mean for LGBT communities. It's been our first segment as part of our annual LGBT health special that we do every year around this time on Health Action in commemoration of LGBT Pride Month. We've been speaking with Kellen Baker, founding steering committee member of Out to Enroll, and Jade Goodridge, who's a patient navigation coordinator at the LGBT Community Center here in New York City. Thanks so much for joining us here on Health Action, Kellen and Jade.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this segment. Bob Letter will be here in the next segment. We'll be hearing excerpts from a recent ACT UP 30th anniversary conference. Stay tuned. I'm Mark Hannay.
This is John Riley for OutFM and Health Action. On June 18th, WBAI's OutFM program co-sponsored a day-long conference with ACT UP New York. That's the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Titled 30 Years of ACT UP New York, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. It was coordinated by Bob Letterer, also of OutFM and Health Action, and myself. On this show, we'll be playing two presentations at that conference, which brought together a remarkable set of voices rarely heard in the corporate media. First, we'll play the opening speech by Bob Letterer, introduced by OutFM producer Naomi Brussel.
And we're going to open with overview speakers to set the context for the day. Former ACT UP New York member Bob Letterer and current members Andy Velez and Terry Wilder. So Bob Letterer was, you saw him earlier when he was looking younger, as we were all in those days. Bob Letterer was an activist with ACT UP New York from 1988 to 2000. In 1988, he co-founded the Alternative and Holistic Treatment Committee. In the late 90s, he helped organize campaigns to transform AIDS research and fund needle exchange programs and expand treatment access to the Global South. Inspired by radical former political prisoner Dr. Alan Berkman, he became a co-founder of Health Gap, or Global Access Project, in 1999. And he's also a longtime print journalist, former senior editor of POS magazine, co-host of Health Action, and a contributing producer on Out FM on WBAI, and also Health Action is also on WBAI radio. For 35 years, he has worked as a queer activist in support of U.S.-held political prisoners, particularly from the Black Liberation and Puerto Rican Independence Movement. So here's Bob.
Good morning, everyone. It's really great to see all of you here. Well, that film always moves me to tears every time. What a time that was. Well, every movement for social change needs to take control of its history, because understanding one's true history is the only way to build on past victories with greater gains and learn from mistakes and setbacks. The well-funded corporate media, publishing, and film industries have generally ignored, downplayed, or demonized progressive movements while they're happening, then decades later rewrites their histories to emphasize white men, invisibilize voices of women, queers, people of color, and people in the global south, among others, while lionizing those who worked only within the system rather than militantly challenging it and refusing to follow its repressive rules. So today's conference is an antidote to all that, to the books, the movies, the articles that have obscured some of the most powerful voices within ACT UP New York and our allies, and some of the most important life-saving victories that we have won. And then there's also our personal histories. Everyone in this room has suffered terrible losses of friends and loved ones to this inexcusable epidemic. We've all experienced insufferable pain. I think it's important to acknowledge that, which was hard to do at the height of the war years of ACT UP. ACT UP was and is a pantheon of sheroes and heroes, and I'd like to dedicate my presentation to three who exemplify the spirit of this conference. Katrina Haslip, who some of you saw in the film before we started. Katrina Haslip, An African-American straight woman who died in 1992 at age 33 became an AIDS educator in a pioneering program started by radical political prisoners while she was at Bedford Hills Correctional Institute, then left prison and became one of the first women of color to speak out as a person with HIV. She plunged into activism, co-founding ACE OUT, an agency to support formerly incarcerated women, and becoming a fierce fighter in ACT UP's Women's Caucus, particularly around the refusal of the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, to broaden the definition of AIDS to cover conditions particularly faced by women, a campaign you'll hear more about later today. I had the good fortune to work with her as a co-producer and guest of the AIDS program on WBAI Radio. She was a tireless advocate for poor and incarcerated women with HIV and an effective educator about paths to community empowerment. Ray Navarro, a Chicano gay man who died in 1990 at age 26, was a brilliant artist and videographer who became a co-founder of ACT UP's Diva TV, that's Damned Interfering Video Activists. He's perhaps best known for playing his beloved hilarious role of Jesus at the huge action at St. Patrick's Cathedral against the anti-gay, anti-woman, and anti-people with AIDS Catholic Church. But far fewer know of his history of radical leftist politics and his role as a member of ACT UP's Majority Actions Committee and the affinity group La Cocina, where I was privileged to work with and get arrested with him, in fiercely advocating to expand our agenda to fight specific murderous government AIDS policies against communities of color and women. He called out racial insensitivity by white people in the group while always maintaining a joie de vivre and deep caring for all those around him. I also must pay tribute to his amazing mother, Patricia, who moved far from home to take care of Ray as he declined and became a beloved and dedicated ACT UP member. Alden McKean, a white gay man who died in 1994 at age 46, brought his long history of radical left organizing, going back to the anti-Vietnam War movement, to ACT UP, a huge boon to our strategizing and organizing. His sharp-tongued refutation of bureaucrats' lies made him an invaluable public spokesperson. But far less known is his role as a passionate advocate for more research on long-term survivors, which he was, and on alternative and nutritional treatments, which he used. Oft forgotten is his consistent advocacy of mutual solidarity and linkage of issues, a politic on which he and I bonded. In one speech, he said, quote, "Why are hospitals being closed in Harlem when the biggest need to improve health care exists right there? Why are there no research efforts into issues that affect women in particular when there's such a crying need? Why do we not have services that can support people who are poor and homeless and prevent them from having to eventually land in an emergency room? All of these issues tie together. Why is the United States one of the two industrialized countries that has no health plan?" These three courageous ACT UP members and many others struggled to broaden ACT UP's focus beyond simply finding effective medicines to challenging the fundamental injustices of our political and economic system that underlay genocidal AIDS policies. Katrina, Ray, and Alden symbolize the hidden histories of ACT UP New York's last 30 years, histories that illuminate a broader view of social change. It's important that in that context that we recall seven key facts, often obscured or distorted, about ACT UP New York. One, we were not the first group to do direct action about AIDS. Several such acts of civil disobedience were done in San Francisco starting in 1984. And an AIDS direct action group called Citizens for Medical Justice formed there in 1986. That group was organized by gay men active in the movements against U.S. wars on Central America and nuclear weapons. In New York, other groups like the Lavender Hill Mob, and I see Bill Bauman here in the audience, who is one of the founders of the Lavender Hill Mob, and kudos for their great work, and the Silence Equals Death Project, began taking action in 1986, many months before ACT UP New York's founding in March 1987. Number two, ACT UP New York did not single-handedly win the many life-saving victories. At its height, ACT UP had, as you saw on the screen, 147 chapters worldwide that changed public awareness and government and corporate policies at the local, national, and global levels. And coalitions, whether with AIDS agencies and advocacy groups, women's health organizations, Black, Latino, Asian community groups, public health lobbies, or all of the above, were instrumental in winning change. Number three, Lesbians and a smaller number of gay men with backgrounds in progressive and left movements played critical roles in formulating ACT UP strategies, tactics, and organizing, and especially its coalition building. They also brought important feminist principles to our work. They shared lessons learned from the feminist health movement, the anti-war and anti-imperialist movements, the civil rights movement, the Black Panther Party, and other black freedom groups, the Latino rights movements, the anti-apartheid movement, and of course, the lesbian and gay liberation movement. I believe that the combination of these experienced radicals and the mass of largely white gay men new to politics who were struggling for their lives and brought that fabulous queer defiance, irreverence, and creativity, generated a powerful synergy that produced the ACT UP movement's early rapid-fire victories. In the years since, those experienced leftists have continued to help keep ACT UP alive and strong. And one of them, just on a personal level, is my wonderful life partner and radical socialist, John Riley. Who I met at an ACT UP meeting 25 years ago, and who worked incredibly hard on every level to make this conference a success. Number four, within ACT UP New York, groups of women, black people, Latinas and Latinos, Asian Pacific Islanders, and current and former drug users often organized into caucuses to create safe, autonomous political and personal spaces have played key roles in both the leadership of the organization and the setting of its political agenda. They have fought for a broader intersectionality of issues and systemic approaches to social change. Number five, though it's ebbed and flowed and was always a stronger feature of ACT UP's in California, ACT UP New York has joined many actions linking the issues of AIDS care and militarism. During the U.S.'s brutal proxy war against the Salvadoran popular insurgency in the 1980s, ACT UP New York endorsed several demos calling for money for AIDS, not for war, U.S. out of El Salvador. In 1990, when Bush Sr. sent thousands of troops to Saudi Arabia, ACT UP organized protests at the Armed Forces recruiting station. And as the drumbeat of war heightened, ACT UP joined massive anti-war coalition marches with feisty chants like, my lick the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia. And as you just saw on screen, our day of desperation in 1991, 6 days after Bush began bombing Iraq, included national TV news studio takeovers, not just the one you saw, but three of them, that brought the slogan, Fight AIDS, Not Arabs, into millions of homes. Number six, ACT UP chapters around the country have faced extensive police brutality, FBI surveillance and harassment, and Secret Service investigations. Arrested women activists have been unjustifiably strip-searched. High-level commanders at police departments under Democratic and Republican mayors alike have been seen giving orders to attack ACT UP's nonviolent civil disobedience actions and sometimes even its law-abiding marches. Many have been injured, most egregiously our own Chris Hennelly, a demo marshal beaten so severely he developed epilepsy. I want to pay special tribute to Bill Thorne, the indomitable ACT UP Golden Gate treatment activist who in 1997 helped lead our 10th anniversary march on Wall Street against pharma price gouging. While Bill was peacefully blocking traffic, a cop repeatedly bashed his head into the concrete shouting, "Die, diseased faggot." When Bill did die 2 years later, his doctor said the beating probably accelerated his disease progression. Both Chris Hennelly, still alive and well, thank the goddess, and Bill's estate won six-figure settlements against the NYPD in actions that were supported by ACT UP New York. And those experiences fueled ACT UP New York's consistent support of coalition actions against police brutality. I want to salute the courage of all the ACT UP members and allies who continued coming out in the streets in the face of this type of savagery. And finally, number seven, the ACT UP movement did not die in the early 90s, okay? Though our ranks, yes, that does deserve applause. This is one of the most common lies about ACT UP. Though our ranks were decimated by deaths, demoralization, and co-optation, particularly by the Clinton administration, we persisted seeded the founding of many other AIDS organizations and went on to win still more victories, which continue through today. And if you look in your program, you'll see that ACT UP family tree that that documents some of those organizations that sprang forth from ACT UP. Now, we've repeatedly heard about ACT UP's role in accelerating and broadening research and FDA approval of effective AIDS drugs. Absolutely crucial victories that should be celebrated. Today's conference will highlight some of the underreported life-saving victories won by ACT UP and our allies. They resulted from combinations of well-researched demands, utilized at rallies, civil disobedience, media work, testimony, lobbying, coalition building, and sometimes litigation. Here I'll just name four campaigns quickly that will be covered in more detail in panels later today. Number one, massively expanding global AIDS treatment access. In 1999, ACT UP New York and ACT UP Philadelphia helped build a broad coalition of AIDS groups and physicians called HealthGap. Working with allies worldwide, particularly South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign, a brilliant organization based, rooted in the anti-apartheid struggle and the gay liberation struggle in South Africa, HealthGap won major funding and changes to government trade policies that provided life-saving, low-cost generic drugs to 17 million people with AIDS throughout the global South. Two, establishing needle exchange and harm reduction programs. Many current and former drug users and community activists have worked to legalize and fund needle exchanges and other harm reduction programs in New York State, nationwide, and globally, and to form drug user unions. ACT UP New York's high-profile civil disobedience in 1990 won a major court victory based on the necessity of needle exchange to stem the AIDS epidemic among injection drug users. And in the late 90s, direct actions and other tactics in coalition with harm reduction groups won federal recognition of these programs' effectiveness. Three, correcting inaccurate AIDS-related science and definitions to include women. And you saw that in the film, so I'm not going to go through that, and you'll be hearing more about that later. Four, expanding rights to affordable health insurance for New York State residents. In the early 1990s, ACT UP New York built a coalition with other disease groups that successfully protested and lobbied to pass laws guaranteeing every resident the right to purchase health insurance at the same price, regardless of gender, age, occupation, or pre-existing condition. This and many other consumer protections were incorporated in the Federal Affordable Care Act in 2010. ACT UP has also long fought for a single-payer national health insurance program. In closing, our history is rich, our victories are many. Help us reclaim that history by spreading the word about what's said here today, and help launch our online archive project on ACT UP's hidden histories. And most importantly, get involved in whatever type of resistance to injustice you can, especially in the heinous Trump era. The need for activism is greater than ever, and ACT UP's potential is unlimited. ACT UP, fight back, end AIDS. ACT UP, fight back, end AIDS. Thank you.
And again, that was Bob Lederer, an activist with ACT UP New York from 1988 to 2000. And Health Action co-producer, speaking at the June 18th conference titled 30 Years of ACT UP, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. And for more on ACT UP, visit actupny.com. Next, we'll hear the talk by Luis Santiago, one of the speakers on the panel, about the Latino Caucus, among the most underreported parts of ACT UP. Luis is introduced by ACT UP member Ken Bing.
All right, our last member of the Latino Caucus is Luis Santiago, who was a member of ACT UP's Latino Caucus from 1990, addressing issues related to the epidemic in that community. In 1998, he joined the board of directors of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, or AVAC. Since his return to ACT UP in 2013, he has focused on expanding access to PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, and helping plan the elimination of hepatitis C in New York. Luis.
Buenas tardes. So I'm going to give some details about a historic campaign, the campaign for Puerto Rico. In terms of background, in 1990, the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Puerto Rico was spreading pretty rapidly, mostly among IV drug users, but also among gay men. At that time, for example, Puerto Rico had the highest per capita rate of new cases of any U.S. jurisdiction, three times the national average. The stigma associated with being HIV positive was very strong, and many persons with HIV were isolated and died not long after diagnosis. There were very few treatments available, not even AZT or pentamidine, and few health services for people with HIV from the government, both at the territory and at the federal level. And so that you know, Medicaid for Puerto Rico is capped at an amount which is much lower proportionally to what the states get based on their population. And in Puerto Rico, 45 to 50% of the population falls under the federal poverty level. So the goals of the Latino campaign were to denounce the criminally inadequate response of the government of the U.S. territory to the AIDS crisis and to spread ACT UP's HIV/AIDS activist model. And I should note here that civil disobedience as a tactic has a history in Puerto Rico. Specifically, in the 1970s, civil disobedience was used to push the U.S. Navy out of the island of Culebra, one of the islands where they used for practice range. And it was a very successful campaign. And it was used again in the 2000s to get the same U.S. Navy out of another island, much larger island, the island of Vieques. And it was also successful, but it was successful mostly because it was done within the context of a diverse coalition of many political forces, which is one of the lessons that we should think about, how to build coalition with a diverse political forces. Anyway, to go through to the campaign plan summary, we wanted to use the opportunity of a scheduled visit by the Secretary of Health at the time. His name was Louis Sullivan, as well as a meeting of the U.S. National Commission on AIDS, which was created in 1988 by Congress in San Juan. So the idea was to send a large contingent, 30 to 40 people, of New York-based ACT UP members to spend several days in Puerto Rico in a series of actions and activities. And of course, we needed to coordinate with local PR Puerto Rican activists connected to the Puerto Rican members of the Latino Caucus in New York. In terms of the pre-Puerto Rico events, so ACT UP approved the campaign and provided funding after a long discussion and a heated debate over whether this was an appropriate action for ACT UP New York. Then a committee was formed to address all the issues regarding travel and lodging facilities for 30 to 40 people. An advanced team was sent to Puerto Rico to coordinate with local activists and determine the best places for actions and other activities. And then education on the situation in Puerto Rico was provided to all the people that were planning to travel. Activities in Puerto Rico. It started with a rally in front of the hotel where the commission was meeting, including die-ins and other tactics used by ACT UP, but also using traditional tactics. In particular, there was a baquiné, which is a traditional child funeral. There were several teachings in schools and community centers, many of them led by women from ACT UP. Members of the Needle Exchange Committee went into La Perla, a community in San Juan with a high incidence of IV drug use and HIV, and gave what were probably the first workshops on the island on cleaning and exchanging needles and information on safe sex to avoid transmission. And all these events culminated with a protest march using the traditional route for protests and demonstrations in Puerto Rico, which is going from the Capitol building in Old San Juan to La Fortaleza, which is the governor's mansion. And this march was pretty radical, and it included a stop in front of the San Juan Cathedral, and we went inside and distributed condoms. And we also, all along the way, we had fake red blood, and we painted our hands against all the walls to dramatize the people that were dying. And this was done all along the way. So achievements, quickly. Never before had the subject of HIV/AIDS had been discussed so intensely in Puerto Rico, with the perspectives of people with HIV and their advocates included in these conversations. ACT UP Puerto Rico was formed with members residing on the island and others who decided to stay and do their work there. ACTO Puerto Rico was active for several years until approximately 1996. It concentrated its efforts on building a coalition of all the small organizations that were working on HIV/AIDS issues in the early 90s. Eventually, partly because of this work, many of these organizations were able to tap Ryan White money and expand their HIV/AIDS programs. This is very important, although there was already a history of gay and lesbian and feminist activism in Puerto Rico, ACT UP activities increased their visibility, especially of LGBT folks, and generated a discussion that helped change people's minds, including folks on the progressive, leftist, and nationalist political circles who traditionally had not been supportive of LGBT rights. The March protest in Old San Juan served as a precursor of the annual San Juan LGBT Pride Parade, which started the following year and is still going strong. And among the lessons learned, number one, intercultural activist collaboration works, but it needs to be led by local activists. And this is a lesson that is very important with our work with Chechnya and Russia and Nigeria and all the countries in the world. They take the lead, we support. There was really a lot of anxiety about how folks in Puerto Rico would take this invasion of Americans, much of them queer on top of that, going to Puerto Rico en masse to talk about sensitive issues about HIV, IV drug use, gay sex. So many people were like, is this the right thing to do? And you know, this is especially important within the context of the unresolved colonial relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States. I mean, the idea of the invasion, whatever. Not that there were any interesting observations and needed to be addressed, but in the end, it was a strong connection between local Puerto Rican activists with Puerto Rican members of the Latino caucus what allowed for the events to work out in a rather organic way. Although there were some critics before and after the process, most people saw the events in a positive light as helping the struggle against HIV in Puerto Rico.
And again, that was Luis Santiago of the ACT UP Latino Caucus. On this show, you've just heard two of the many presentations made at the conference on June 18th, titled 30 Years of ACT UP, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. For more excerpts, go to outfm.org, and for more on ACT UP New York, visit actupny.com. This is John Riley with Bob Lederer for OutFM and Health Action.
For WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry. Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building where WBAI's transmitter has been since 1965, has refused to negotiate with Pacifica in a lawsuit over our antenna lease. It filed a motion for summary judgment in New York State Supreme Court against WBAI Pacifica, the not-for-profit and non-commercial radio network. They claim WBAI owes them $2.1 million, increasing each month on our lease for the last 3 years. The onerous lease goes until 2020, with an additional obligation of $2 million more for the next 3 years of the lease. WBAI's operations and Pacifica's would be put in serious jeopardy if the judge grants the motion. The longer story, though, here involves the Empire State Building and its parent corporation taking advantage of the World Trade Center's antenna being destroyed in 9/11. This eliminated competition and left WBAI with no choice but to sign an unconscionable lease with large increases each year. The lease now says we should pay more than four times the present market rate of $12,000 a month. That's right. There's an attempt for your listener dollars to be swindled by our being charged four times the market rate. We're asking our state and local representatives to speak with Empire State Realty Trust to, one, resume negotiations with WBAI Pacifica to reach an equitable settlement in the lawsuit, two, to be reasonable and negotiate with us in good faith and release WBAI from the remainder of its lease with no penalty, and three, to waive the interest, late fees, and legal fees that have been accumulated in the last 3 years while we were only paying the market rate rather than what's in the lease. If you want to join the call to action and help listeners sponsor WBAI, please contact your local council members and representatives and senators and ask them to step in on behalf of WBAI. Many thanks. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Deviating slightly from our usual discussion of literary science fiction, fantasy, and the like, and following from last week's program with Terrence Taylor, we will have this week's program with Terrence Taylor, resuming that conversation. Stay tuned. Oh yeah, and in case you didn't notice, we are broadcasting, not just webcasting. Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date June 29th, 2017, The Bad Batch, take one. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There are few disturbing things about Anna Lily Amirpour's new dystopic near-future quasi-western, The Bad Batch. One comes near the beginning of the film when Suki Waterhouse, playing Arlen, a woman who for some reason winds up declared a quote-unquote bad batch by the U.S. government and is exiled to a kind of earthbound phantom zone south of the Texas border, gets captured by a group of cannibals and has her right arm and leg harvested. The sequence isn't particularly gory, but otherwise leaves little to the imagination. The second moment comes when Keanu Reeves, playing the drug lord who presides over the hedonistic community of Comfort, that's the name of the place, Comfort, espies the 7 or 8-year-old girl whom Arlen took from the cannibals after killing her mother, and takes the kid into his Greco-Roman-style palace, the implication being that the kid will eventually be indoctrinated into his corps of pregnant bodyguards. Again, the girl is 8 years old, still got a few years if that's the plan, but even then, ew, don't dwell on that thought too much. But the third thing is admittedly more personal. Throughout most of the film, I kept trying to think of the terms that would sum up Arlen's attitude to the events she finds herself enmeshed in. I kept coming up with phrases like feather in the wind, leaf in the stream. So when Reeves's drug lord, toward the end of the film, likens her to a sailboat drifting on windless waters, that kind of threw me. You don't expect a film to go, no, no, here's the phrase you were thinking of. Which means it wasn't just me who was getting hung up on this aspect of the character. It's what Ms. Amirpour wanted. That's a problem, because it's not the easiest thing to take the part of a character who's kind of just drifting through the scenario. And it doesn't help when, in the latter half of the film, Arlen encounters the young girl's father, played by Jason Momoa, and starts falling in love with him. Keep in mind that this is one of the people who was chowing down on Arlen's steak at the beginning of the film. Also remember that Arlen killed the mother of this man's child in an act of cold-blooded vengeance. So when he starts to reciprocate her feelings, that's just weird. Amirpour may be trying to say something about moral relativism here. And keep in mind that we're in a land of outcasts anyway, so these are people who largely have lived outside societal norms. But when these two people start making moony eyes at each other, I at least was thinking, okay, you guys got a lot of baggage to still get over before taking this to the next level. Amirpour does load the film with evocative imagery, stocking her cannibal enclave with chiseled bodybuilders and making Comfort a chaotic community of outcasts with copious drugs and nightly raves. Giovanni Ribisi and Jim Carrey are in there too. This is Mad Max if the overall attitude wasn't so much hell yeah as, ooh, I don't know. The Bad Batch works to an extent. I would have liked a little more commitment. Philippine director Avid Leongarin has no trouble committing to his world. In his romantic comedy fantasy Saving Sally, which will be running at the New York Asian Film Festival in a few weeks, his main character Marty, played by Enzo Marcos, is a young comics artist who sees the world as if Michel Gondry had decided to take a more positive attitude toward life, stocked with whimsical technology from a bling-bedecked bus to a Fleischer-esque twisted telescope to a public park whose name is a pun on a Philippine singing star and whose inhabitants oscillate between their human forms and animated cartoon monsters. That Marty sees the crush of his life, Sally, an inventor of even more whimsical machinery, played by Rian Ramos, in hyperbolic, exalted terms, isn't that much of a surprise. That the scenario saddles him with being a go-between between Sally and her tool-like boyfriend, the film literally renders him in his monster form as a giant tool, if you get my meaning, is unfortunate, portraying Marty as a doormat and Sally as, at best, obliviously manipulative for too long. Nothing wrong with director Leongarin wishing to cast some shadows into the sunny little world of Saving Sally. It needs it, actually, to avoid whimsy overload. I just wanted to respect his characters as much as I admire his technique. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. Sorry, everybody, I did not edit the opening of that. I did edit the opening of that. And, it's been a day. It's been a very, very long day. So, Matt, you're on the air. So, We don't have much in the way of soundproofing here. So as people are trying to deal with other business, like I presume what goes on at 5 a.m., we have to tell Lister. I think we know what it is. Nevertheless, we will do it. Terrence, are you there?
I should be.
Oh, yes, you certainly are, and it sounds pretty decent for Skype. Okay. Skype to Skype is pretty decent. Skype to phone still really sucks. But, you know, it sounds like a phone call. But I have to admit, for lo these many years, I've always resisted doing phoners, shall we say. Aside from the fact that they are less personal. You don't have the person you can't give meaningful looks to or something like that. Aside from simply the in-room presence, the idea of talking to somebody on the air for 2 hours on the phone has always struck me as poor-sounding radio. But this isn't so bad.
No, I listened to it last week. It sounded quite good.
Yeah, there's a slight hollowness. But it's not too bad. So before we get into talking, continuing last week's discussion, which I had a lot of fun and we had a few points, both of us, each of us, all of us, I have to do a promo that, well, peripherally involves you, because I know that you're going to say you do it, but I make the announcement anyway. A week from tonight, today being Thursday in New York City, that is to say July 6th, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings begins its very first summer series. And it would normally were the first Tuesday of the month, but that would be on July 4th. And somehow I have a feeling July 4th might be a conflict for one or two people.